have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Let's get started with local and a poll.
Yes.
It was a slow week.
It was a slow week, yes. And so the pollsters kind of come out of the woodwork and start calling people up and asking them questions. And this week, Elway released a poll. They did a poll asking Washington State voters how they would vote today on three of the November ballot initiatives. And what they found was that Initiative 1163, which would require background checks and training for home health care workers, that had a huge amount of support. About 77% of respondents said that they supported outright. And then they
bear in mind that initiative already passed once, and then the state legislature didn't fund it, which is why it's on the ballot again.
Right, it's on the ballot now to try to force the state legislature to fund it. Initiative 1183, on the other hand, the liquor privatization bill that is widely supported by Costco, that would allow stores with over 10,000 square feet to sell booze and would privatize the liquor distribution system in the state of Washington. That initiative got 50% support, with 38% opposing and 12% undecided.
And didn't that fail last year?
Yes, it failed last year. And
what's different this year?
Well, the liquor privatization bill would the difference is that the 10,000 square foot rule means it was meant to address objections that a lot of people had with the last year's bill, saying that last year's bill, if it had passed, would have allowed any corner store to sell booze and would have made it widely available to minors. The 10,000.
So now Costco is saying that it can only be sold at big box stores?
Yeah, that it can only be sold at big box stores. However, this week too, there was an analysis done of Initiative 1183 that showed that there might be a loophole in that 10,000 square foot rule, that the state could approve smaller retailers to sell liquor. And so opponents are starting to try to use that as a way to undermine Initiative 1183. What this poll shows is that having only 50% support means that it's going to be a bit of an uphill battle going towards the November election for 1183 to pass. In addition, I-1125, the Iman initiative that would require the state legislature to set tolls, not a commission, an appointed commission to set tolls, and then would require any tolls collected on any roads or bridges in the state of Washington to be spent only on the projects where the tolls are collected. That initiative only had 49% support. And usually the rule of thumb is that when you roll out an initiative, it should start out with about 60% support if you want to guarantee it passing in November. Of course, you could alternatively argue that a poll taken in August is very, very different from a poll taken in October, that in the next couple months we'll find out whether or not support goes up or down. But Initiative 1125, the polling initiative, has raised $1.3 million versus most of it from Costco and other big box stores.
The liquor initiative, you mean?
The liquor initiative, yeah, versus only $67,000 raised by the opponents. So it may be a bit of an uphill battle, but in a couple months with all that cash laying around, it may not be that close. Initiative 1183, the Costco initiative, on the other hand, has raised about $2.4 million versus nearly $4 million that the opponents have raised, mostly from liquor wholesalers.
All right. Moving on, internal memo.
Yeah. Last week, not this week, but the week before last, the Seattle Transit blog got a hold of an internal Metro report on what eliminating the ride-free zone would do to travel times, bus travel times in downtown. And what the report showed, and this was not released to the public, I wonder why. What this report showed was that travel on 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Avenues northbound would be slower, but it would be acceptable. Third Avenue southbound, on the other hand, would be borderline acceptable on a good day, and that travel times on Third Avenue southbound could completely fail altogether if there were any traffic disruptions or tunnel closures. And you know how often traffic disruptions happen in downtown, usually about once a week or every other week. And
more often than that.
Or sometimes more often than that. Yeah, and the tunnel, the travel times would be very similar to Third Avenue southbound. Travel times would increase between 2 to 8 minutes for tunnel buses. Fixing the delays would mean either decreasing the number of buses from 60 an hour that go through the tunnel right now down to 40 to 45 buses per hour, or it would mean forcing Sound Transit trains to run less often. And that's if no mitigation measures are taken. Now, there are several things that they could do if they eliminate a ride-free zone in downtown, as they say they are going to do, that would help travel times in the tunnel and along 3rd Avenue South and other stops downtown. They could install a ticket vending or Orca card readers at several stops so that people don't have to pay as they're getting on the bus. This would be particularly good in the tunnel, having people pay before they go down the stairs or the escalator to the platform. They could program Sound Transit pass readers in the tunnel to also read Orca cards and other passes, which they probably should have done from the beginning, I think. And they could restrict auto traffic on 3rd, although they've already done that to a certain extent.
Yeah, they do that during rush hours.
During rush hour, yeah. They could run fewer trains in the tunnel. But then again, the tunnel was built explicitly not just for buses, but also for light rail. And the idea was that light rail would be the dominant form of transit in the tunnel, and I think that that is true now. They could allow tunnel buses to board anywhere on the on the long platforms in the station. Those platforms are about 2 blocks long. That could be a problem for elderly or disabled passengers trying to get to their bus, I think. And, of course, they could just keep the ride-free zone. So
yeah, well, actually, they can't keep the ride-free zone unless county council takes action, because that was part of the deal by which they put the $20 car tab into effect rather than putting it on the November ballot.
Yeah, and I think this report really shows that the ride-free zone has its advantages, particularly in keeping buses on schedule and on time and allowing a large number of buses to make it through the downtown choke points.
Yeah, the irony of this is that the ride-free zone elimination was the concession for the $20 car tab increase that was forced by nonpartisan county council members with Republican membership, party membership, in order to quote-unquote save money. Well, they're not going to save money, because most of the mitigation for this, if they don't mitigate this, which will cost money, it will cost the metro ridership and the number of routes that it can run.
Yeah, excuse me. Mitigation costs money, and if they don't mitigate, that costs money too, because if buses don't run on time, fewer people ride them.
All right. Moving on, article in the Atlantic about one of our own congresspeople here.
Yeah, the Atlantic magazine came out this week with an interesting article that was looking at why senators and representatives in the U.S. Congress in the wake of both the town hall demonstrations of a couple summers ago by Tea Partiers, and especially the Gabrielle Giffords shooting last January, why they're releasing their schedule with very little advance notice in many cases anymore, so as to which they claim is for security reason. But in particular, they singled out one congressman as refusing to release his public schedule at all. In other words, only giving his public schedule to people who are already on his mailing list, and essentially just through not making the information available to anybody else, making sure that he appears only before friendly audiences, that being our own representative, Dave Reichert. Now, the Atlantic also made an interesting connection in this.
Good old Sheriff Dave.
Yeah, good old Sheriff Dave. You know, the man who got elected based largely on his raw moral courage in staring down Gary Ridgway while he was, you know, handcuffed to a table. you know, they made an interesting connection between Reichert's reluctance to release his public schedule and several recent demonstrations that have been held in front of his offices by people opposing various of his votes. So, Dave Reichert, the man of moral courage, the big man's man, the former sheriff, seems like he's a bit of a coward. Can we say that?
Bit of a mouse.
All right, moving on. The Seattle Times reporting on state cutbacks.
Yes, the Seattle Times had an article this week that local and state governments here in Washington have cut back about 7%, and that includes a lot of layoffs. What I found very interesting about that report was I clicked on the comments section to read what people's comments were. Now, taking into account that the readers of the Seattle Times are a pretty conservative bunch, because the Seattle Times leans towards the conservative.
If you've ever read the comments section, oh boy.
Yeah, but I found it really startlingly bad. A lot of the comments said, you know, it's about time and we should cut more and the cuts should be double that, or no, triple that, no, quadruple that. But I think the most idiotic comment that I read of all is that, and I think it kind of sums up what all these people think about government, is that, quote, money spent on government services is removed from the economy, end quote. That was the comment I read, and it got a lot of, yeah, you're right, et cetera. But no, it is absolutely startlingly wrong and ignorant to say something like that. Any money spent
on... Which makes it a basic Tea Party platform.
Yes. Any money spent on government services is recycled directly back into the economy. It does not disappear from the economy. For example, if you pay sales tax, your sales tax pays the wage of firemen. It pays for school teachers. It pays for any number of state workers. Those folks have mortgages to pay. They have rent to pay. They have to buy food. They have to buy clothes. They pay sales tax, etc. It all gets recycled directly back into the economy. So anybody who says that spending money on government services is a waste does not understand how the economy works, period. Now, I can think of an example, however, of money that is spent that does not benefit the economy in any productive way. Take, for example, when the U.S. government gives a tax break to a major corporation. Now, we can pick any major corporation to talk about that you want, but I think I'd just say, you know, Microsoft, maybe.
That's the one I was going to suggest.
Microsoft pays some wages to employees, and they buy some supplies and things, but a lot of their cash profits are just sitting in offshore accounts, not really doing anything. Now, say the U.S. government gives Microsoft a big, big tax break to bring that cash home, with the idea that they will spend that cash on wages and buying supplies and buying new equipment, etc. Microsoft says, okay, I'll take that tax break, and they bring their cash home to U.S. accounts. But what do they do with it? Do they hire a lot of people? Do they buy a lot of equipment? Do they buy new computers and so forth? Well, they may do a little of that, but as it's turned out in this economy, most corporations are not doing that. They have a record amount of cash sitting on their books, and they're just sitting on it.
I was going to suggest that they transfer to a subsidiary in the Cayman Islands.
Now, what they... They're bringing it
after
home from
no,
the
Cayman after, Islands. No, after they've brought it home. I mean.
After they've transferred it back, yeah. A company like Microsoft, say, might spend some of that cash. What companies are spending that cash on mostly are three things. First off, they're paying dividends. Dividends, oh, that's getting recycled back into the economy, right? Well, only a very, very tiny amount of dividends gets recycled back into the economy. Think about it. A little bit of those dividends get paid to mom and pops in their retirement accounts, but it doesn't get spent. It sits there. So it's effectively removed. It's not being very productive in the economy, and it's not boosting those mom and pops' ability to spend more money. Or it may boost their ability to borrow a little more money, but nobody is trying to borrow more money these days. A little bit more of those dividends go into taxable accounts for retired folks, but not very much. Most of the dividends go into the hands of wealthy people who already have too much money that they can't spend. Again, the money sits in investment accounts and doesn't do a whole lot. It's not very productive, not nearly as productive in the economy as when you pay somebody wages. And you might say, well, the rich folks, they get that money, they pay tax on it, right? Oh, they do, but they pay only a 15% tax on it. If they were collecting that money as a wage, they would pay more than double the tax on it. So there again, dividends.
And that's the base rate before all the loopholes.
Yes. And there again, dividends are much, much less productive than money spent on paying people to do jobs, whether those jobs are in the private sector or in the government sector. Another thing that corporations are doing with their cash is they're buying other companies in mergers, which isn't always productive either. Again, a lot of people get laid off in a merger, so that cuts down on the amount of money recycled into the economy. In addition, in a buyout, most of the profit goes to, again, shareholders, who, again, are mostly wealthy people. And then the third thing that a lot of companies are doing are stock buybacks. Again, they're buying their stock from shareholders. The money is going to wealthy people. So, you know, I can think of many ways in which cash is not being spent very productively in the economy. It's being in many instances removed from the economy. But spending it on government services does not make that list at all.
All right. The tar sands, they're having a lot of protests in front of the White House this week, I know.
Yeah, there have been some 400 people arrested in front of the White House this week trying to influence the State Department, which was due this week to make a decision on whether to approve a pipeline between the tar sands of northern Alberta and refineries in Oklahoma and the Houston area on the Gulf Coast. And lo and behold, on Friday, the State Department, run by that noted liberal Hillary Clinton, who works for another noted liberal named Barack Obama, approved the 1,700-mile-long pipeline that would carry heavy oil from Alberta to the Gulf Coast. The project still has to clear several hurdles before the end of the year, that being federal agencies, more studies, and public hearings. But all signs point to the Obama administration making a final approval by the year end. That was really one of the biggest hurdles for it to go through, with the pipeline expected to open in 2013 unless a surprising amount by the inevitable lawsuits they're going to follow on this also. The report by the State Department that justified this decision said that, quote, no significant impacts to most environmental resources, there would be no significant impacts to most environmental resources along the pipeline's corridor, even though tar sands have a higher, maybe the other way of putting that is that there would be no significant additional impacts to environmental resources along the pipeline's corridor other than the environmental impacts that will affect all of us, which is to say that tar sands have a higher carbon footprint than any other commercial oil product on the planet. For many environmentalists, the administration's apparent acceptance of the pipeline, You can add it to the list after decisions to tentatively approve drilling in the Arctic Ocean, open 20 million more acres of the Gulf of Mexico for oil leasing, and delay several major air quality regulations, along with the complete failure of the Obama administration. This, you have to give a lot of the credit to the Republicans in Congress to get any kind of climate change legislation through. So it's been a grim time recently for environmental regulation and environmental initiatives, and this one has to be placed squarely at the feet of the Obama administration.
Moving on, article out this week on the which Counterspin just covered briefly, on the New York Police Department and CIA alliance.
Yeah, the AP investigative report this week, the intelligence division of the NYPD in the wake of 9/11 was set up as a miniature CIA, bringing in a senior CIA official who stayed on the CIA payroll and ran out of operated out of two offices, one the CIA office in Manhattan and then also the NYPD headquarters at City Hall in Manhattan, you know, out near City Hall in Manhattan at the same time.
I thought that was illegal.
Well, funny you should say that. That question has been raised. There were a number of problems with this arrangement. One of them is the basic legality of it, given that the CIA is forbidden from operating on U.S. soil. And not only were they sharing payroll in this case, but there was also active cooperation between the agencies in terms of the sharing of intelligence. And in fact, the FBI was refusing to accept counterterrorism leads from the NYPD Intelligence Division because they felt that they were gathered in illegal fashion. The other problems involved in this had to do with what they were actually doing to gather that information, which included things like infiltration of every mosque within 100 miles of New York City, pretext traffic stops in Pakistani neighborhoods to try and leverage Muslims into becoming intelligence assets for the NYPD. As I said, payroll cooperation with the CIA itself, and no accountability whatsoever. The city council in New York City wasn't interested in looking at this.
No,
Congress
exactly.
hasn't been interested in holding hearings on this.
Amazing.
Federal officials haven't been interested in it at all. And hopefully now this has been daylighted a little bit, it will get a little bit more attention. As they mentioned on Counterspin, Mayor Bloomberg shut down a press conference this week when somebody asked him about this report. And so it's clearly a sensitive topic for some people, and hopefully it'll become a more sensitive topic
yes.
as we and hopefully we'll learn a little bit more about what this has entailed. And because, you know, the most generous thing you can say about this is that once again we are seeing a significant erosion in the civil liberties of American citizens on American soil.
Wow. So that doesn't appear to be the only storm hitting New York currently then.
No.
That's right.
Not at all.
Right. And we hope the one doesn't drive it from the headlines.
Yeah. Yes, and you know, and,
so
and there's
happens.
And there is
yes.
no and there is no truth to the rumor that Irene is a Muslim plot.
Let's move on. A couple reports out this week. One from Pew.
Well, polls.
Polls.
Yeah.
Oh, more polls.
More polls. It is the end of August. Both Pew and AP had reports this week in the wake of the debt ceiling fiasco that came to a culmination earlier this month. The Pew report showed a number of things tracking from February to this August. One, that Obama's approval rating had gone down as a result of the debt ceiling fiasco from 49 approved, 42 disapproved in February to 43 approved, 49 disapproved in August. But he didn't take nearly as much of a hit as the Republican Party, Congress, and the Tea Party. The Republican Party's favorables went from 43 yes, 48 no to 34 no, 34 yes, 59 no. Congress went from 34 favorable, 57 unfavorable, to 25 favorable, 70% unfavorable, which is, you know, really as close as you're going to find to a consensus in a democratic society, unless you actually reference the AP poll, which Maria's going to do in a second.
Yes.
And then attitudes toward the Tea Party went from 33% favorable, 25% unfavorable, with the rest undecided, not having an opinion, to 36 favorable, 43 unfavorable. Only 11% of Americans were basically content with the operations of the federal government, and only 26% have an excellent or good impression of Republican candidates for president. So the big takeaway from all of this seems to be a pox on all their houses, but particularly a pox on the houses of the nutcase Republicans.
Yes, and I think it proves, too, that the American people are not stupid. They understand somewhat
well,
what's going on.
Well, most of them.
Most of them, unless they write comments on the Seattle Times website. The AP poll was very interesting because it showed that the approval level of Congress in general has dropped to its lowest level since AP has been doing these polls. It is now about 12%. That's down from 21% in June. There were two parts of the poll that I found very interesting. One was when they talked to independents, and independents said that 65% of them said that they want their House representative tossed out in 2012. So independents, who tend not to be either rabidly for the Democrats or for the Republicans, folks who generally don't consider themselves one or the other, they pretty much think that the House did a very, very, very bad job, the Republican-controlled House, this summer. In addition, independents also said that they think that in order to fix the economy, the debt is not so important. What is important is that taxes must be raised. That, and I would say that they are probably correct in that estimation.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with Libya.
Well, okay, we can start. Hey, guess what? Colonel Gaddafi has a crush on Condoleezza
Rice. Lisa.
Lisa, yes, his special African queen. Above and beyond that, we were talking this time last week that rebels seem to be making significant advances into Tripoli. Well, they certainly did. Over the weekend, they managed to overrun much of Tripoli and have been cleaning up operations since then. Then the Libyan port city of Sirte, which is a Gaddafi stronghold, is really the last remaining major place that has not been taken over by the Libyan rebels. And a lot of questions are being raised in the aftermath of the overrun, particularly about what the future is going to hold for Libya, and particularly the immediate future, because this is starting to look an awful lot like Baghdad in 2003, where there's no real security, where there's a lot of infighting among the rebels, and where there's a serious question of who's accountable for what and what kind of human rights violations are being perpetrated in the chaos.
Yeah, and when I heard that that Muammar Gaddafi had disappeared, the very first thing that came up in my mind was 2003 in Iraq, when Saddam had disappeared, nobody knew where he was, and an insurgency started to form in the wake of his disappearance. And I would not be surprised if a similar thing happened in Libya, that Muammar Gaddafi goes underground and the folks who supported him during his rule decide that they can't because they can't participate in the government, they're going to try to overthrow the new government. Now, there are a lot of similarities between Libya and Iraq. Libya is not as much of a modern state as you would think, as Iraq was not as much of a modern state. Both rulers, both Saddam and Gaddafi, exploited a lot of the tribal divisions within their countries in order to stay in power. They haven't tried to pull their population out of tribal allegiances into an allegiance to a modern state, which would avoid internal warfare after they've been overthrown. And so I would not be surprised if the tribes that have been loyal to Muammar Gaddafi are locked out of any kind of a power sharing in Libya, just as the groups that were loyal to Saddam Hussein in Iraq have been locked out of the new government in Iraq, and it's led to pretty much a low intensity civil war.
Yeah, the other thing that we're learning in the aftermath of all this is not only human rights abuses perpetrated by Gaddafi, which are getting the majority of the play in American media. But if you look at foreign media, we're also starting to learn more about abuses that have been perpetrated and propaganda that's been perpetrated on behalf of the rebels. And in particular, a lot of the claims that were being made in February that were the justification initially for the NATO intervention in it, turned out to not have much supporting evidence. Things like the African mercenaries coming in, some of those claims, there has not been a lot of firm evidence to support those since then. And we're seeing now that the West, and particularly France, Britain, and the United States, rushed in to provide support to an effort to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi based upon human rights claims that may or may not have had merit. We're not sure at this point.
Just a minute for Fukushima.
Yeah, just a couple of things on Fukushima this week. The plant, or the areas around the plant, the 12-mile radius and a little bit further out from Fukushima, the Japanese government finally admitted this week that area is going to be a no-man's land, going to have to be a no-man's land for at least several decades, that the temporary evacuation that was undertaken after the earthquake and tsunami in Japan is going to become a more or less permanent one for at least the next generation of Japanese living that used to live within at least 12 miles of the plant. That's no surprise. That's what happened in Chernobyl in the Ukraine. And I find it kind of ironic that folks were saying, oh, this is not as bad as Chernobyl, et cetera. But try to tell that to the Japanese public right now. In addition,
in many ways, it looks like it was worse.
Yeah, and in addition, there was some news in recent weeks that that was reported by the Independent of the UK saying that it turns out the plant, the Fukushima Daiichi plant, was not destroyed by the tsunami as early reports had suggested, that really it was the earthquake that undermined the plant, and that the meltdowns started before, that the heating of the reactor cores started long before the tsunami actually hit the plants. And that puts into question the safety of many older generation nuclear power plants in the United States that sit near or on earthquake faults.
Yeah, there are a lot more plants near earthquake faults than there are in tidal zones.
Yes.
All right. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org, all one word. That's where you find it. Check it out.